Welcome everyone to IPS. For some of you, this might be your first time at IPS, for some not, and for some it might be your first time in this office. We moved here a few months ago, so welcome. I want to thank our co-sponsors of this brown bag, the National Lawyers Guild, the DC chapter, and the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CIPER. I am Manuel Perez Rocha and work on the Global Economic Project of IPS. And for our project, the coup in Brazil is of particular concern, given the regional and global implications and the tremendous reverse in a more fair and global balance of power. It certainly, the coup diminishes hopes to all Latin Americans. I am Mexican, you can hear from my accent. For all Latin Americans, it certainly diminishes our hopes. All Latin Americans who saw in Brazil and other countries of Latin America in the region, a shift from the neoliberal paradigm. This era in Latin America seems to be passing, and we need to reconstruct this hope and this dream, almost from the ashes. As our counterpart in the region, the REBRIP, which is the Brazilian Network for People's Integration, this is one of the networks IPS has worked many years with, they have warned that the coup in Brazil is parallel to the dismantling of alternative regional integration mechanisms, namely the Mercosur, which is now an institution in crisis. So before passing the word to our speakers, Asade, who's yet to come, Aline, and Alex, who I welcome, I'd like to let you know that each year, IPS honors our colleagues, Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Carpen Moffitt, who were killed in 1975 with a bomb planted in their car by the regime of President Pinochet, right here in Washington. Just a couple of weeks ago, we celebrated their lives and their work with IPS at the Sheridan Circle, a few blocks away from here, with the presence of their families and of the President of Chile, Michelle Bachelet. And during 40 years, our institute has awarded human rights heroes in our hemisphere with the Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Awards. Over these 40 years, we have given three awards to Brazilians. In 1982, to Cardinal Paulo Evaristo Arns of Sao Paulo, Brazil. In 1989, to the Union of Indigenous Nations of Brazil. And in 2003, nada menos y nada más, that to ex-president Lula. So, let me introduce the panel. Let's start with Aline. Christian Piva, who is an activist of the Brazilian Landless Movement and a specialist in international relations at the University of Brasilia, and in international law at the University of Londrina, Brazil. Alex Main is a senior associate for international policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CIPER, whose work focuses on U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America and the Caribbean. Alex just returned from Brazil, meeting with many social movement leaders. So just to introduce this panel, let me say that on August 31st, the right-wing forces in Brazil impeached President Dilma Rousseff on spurious grounds, thus setting back the Workers' Party social justice programs and implementing an austerity program that will most gravely affect the working class and the largest Afro-descent population outside of Nigeria. Afro-Brazilians suffer some of the most blatantly egregious poverty, racism, and discrimination in the world, including being subjected to the highest official police murder rates of black youth. 6-7 are killed daily, as recently reported by the Washington Post. The overwhelmingly white protests backing the ouster of the president, Rousseff, combined with attacks by the right-wing, all-white male Temer government, that has dismantled the Special Ministry Against Racial Discrimination, revealed the racial divide within the current political crisis in Brazil. So we'll hear from our panelists about the lead-up to the coup and what the social justice movements in Brazil need from us, what we can do from Washington. The discussion will recount how race and class in Brazil are nearly indistinguishable and the various ways the weight of reactionary policies will fall heaviest on the country's predominantly black and low-income populations. So I also welcome Asadeh Shashahani, who is a legal and advocacy director with Project South and a past president of the National Lawyers Guild. In July, Shashahani served as a juror for the International Tribunal on Democracy in Brazil. So please, I leave you the word if you want to take 10 to 15 minutes, not more, and then we can have a round of discussion, and above all, a discussion on what we can do here in Washington, what actions can we continue taking, and also a little recount of what we've done already in the past few months. Asadeh, please. Or who wants to start? Do you have an order already?
Yes.
Aline Asadeh, Alex. Aline, please.
So, first of all, I would like to thank you all for being here today. And I also would like to thank IPS for organizing this event. As Manuel said, the coup in Brazil is not only a coup against the Brazilian people and the Brazilian democracy, but it's also part of a broader offensive throughout Latin America. It is offensive against the progressive governments and the social achievements that we have had in the past 20 years throughout Latin America. So, on August 31st, the Brazilian Senate voted to oust democratically elected President Dilma Rousseff. Rousseff was impeached under allegations of fiscal and budgetary irregularities. However, those allegations were so fragile that 16 of the 61 senators who voted for her definitive removal also decided to maintain her political rights. This is something that demonstrates that her impeachment was only a legal facade for what is in fact a forcible and unconstitutional regime change in Brazil. The major political impetus behind Rousseff's impeachment was to shield politicians from corruption investigations, and this was made really clear when Romero Jucá, which a senator who was appointed by Temer as Minister of Planification, when he was caught on a wiretap saying to Sérgio Machado, the head of Transpetro, one of the oil companies in Brazil, saying that the only way to stop the bleeding that was being made in the political scenario by the car wash operation, the investigations that are being conducting on the corruption scheme in Petrobras, was to remove Rousseff and put Temer in power. It is also a coup to impose a new liberal agenda that not only undermines Brazil's sovereignty, but also puts at risk all social achievements and all social progress that we had in the past 13 years in Brazil. It is a coup against a broader political project that was being implemented by the Workers' Party. A project that was perceived by the Brazilian political establishment as a threat, and also as a threat to the interests and the privileges of the economic ruling class in Brazil. So, Rousseff's impeachment, although many analysts, including progressive analysts, are trying to argue that it was a legal process, a constitutional process, it was in fact a carefully planned scheme to impose an economic and social agenda that was consistently rejected by Brazilian people in the ballot box. So, and we have been saying this for a long time, and we had a definitive proof of that when Michel Temer, the now de facto president of Brazil, he said on his last trip here to New York that Rousseff's impeachment was a process that was initiated because she did not implement the economic agenda that was being proposed by his party, the PMDB. So this economic agenda is called a bridge to the future, and they proposed this when Temer was still vice president, that was still tweeting that the impeachment is something unthinkable, it is unconstitutional, and then when she refused to implement it, it changed sides, and, we got impeached. So, why do we say that this is a regime change? Because when Temer was still on a provisional mandate, Temer nominated a new cabinet, as Manuel said. A new cabinet in 2016 that is all white, all male. We don't have women, we don't have minorities. And he also eliminated ministers that were traditionally aligned with social and popular demands. Now that Temer holds the de facto presidency of the country, he's rolling back gains in labor and social security, denationalizing the exploitation of natural resources, and advancing adjustments to the economy to accommodate international capital. Just yesterday, the Brazilian Congress passed a law that denationalized the exploitation of oil in the largest reserves in Brazil that we call pre-sal. This is something, and this is really interesting, because this law to nationalize the exploitation was passed in 2006. And when this passed, WikiLeaks just released these cables in a couple of months ago. When the law passed, the now Foreign Minister of Brazil, José Serra, met with U.S. diplomats at the U.S. in Brazil, at the U.S. Embassy in Brazil, and he specifically said that when they got into power, they would roll back this law. This was a law that not only nationalized the exploitation of the oil reserves, but also instituted that the revenue of that exploitation, 30% of the revenue of that exploitation, had to go to healthcare and education. So, all these changes are being met with protests in almost every Brazilian state. One thing that I think it is important to understand is that although the coup in Brazil is not a classic coup d'etat in the sense that we are not yet seeing tanks on the streets, that doesn't mean that the military didn't that the coup didn't count with some level of complicity of the Brazilian army. So what led us to think this is that one of Temer's first actions when he was still on a provisional mandate was to remilitarize the ABIN, which is the Brazilian intelligence agency. The general that he nominated, he appointed to be the head of the Brazilian intelligence arm, is a guy called Sérgio Etchegoyen, and he comes from a long line of high-ranked militaries that played important roles during the military dictatorship in Brazil. For example, his father was the head of the Brazilian of the law enforcement in the South State called Rio Grande do Sul, and he was the guy who invited Dan Mitrione, the CIA agent in charge of torture techniques. And he was the guy who brought Dan Mitrione to Brazil to teach those techniques to Brazilian law enforcement. His uncle was the head of one place that we call the House of Death, which is a place that under the military dictatorship, political prisoners were taken to that place for torture and then, as the military said, disappeared. Oh, I'll just be really quick, sorry. So I think this is important because we need to understand that Brazilian institutions, the institutions within the Brazilian government play an important role. The first one, the military, even though it was a covert role, but two other institutions played openly open roles. The first one was the Congress. We have evidence that congressmen were holding meetings 1 year before the impeachment started to plot how they were going to implement the impeachment process. And also the complicity of the judiciary that systematically refused to rule if evident breaches of the due process. Why I bring this up is because many members of the U.S. government and the other levels of analysis, when instigated to comment on Rousseff's impeachment, they have said that Brazil has strong institutions, strong democratic institutions. And I think it is important for us to have it very clear that Rousseff's impeachment is not only a huge blow to Brazilian democracy, but it also highlights how government institutions in Brazil can exceed their constitutional role and manipulate political circumstances against the will of Brazilian people. Thank you.
Thank you, Aline. So, who is next?
Me. Thank you so much. I wanted to thank the Institute for Policy Studies for hosting us today, and apologies for being late. I'm from Atlanta and underestimated the traffic in D.C. But so I wanted to specifically talk about the tribunal on democracy in Brazil that was held this past July. And I had the privilege of being one of the 8 jurors that the social justice movements in Brazil had invited to basically look at the impeachment proceedings against President Rousseff. And just in terms of the organizations that were in support of the tribunal, so the tribunal was organized by Via Campesina International, the Brazil Popular Front, and the Brazilian Jurist Front for Democracy, and it was supported by several organizations, social justice movements, including the MST, the Landless Workers Movement. And, you know, I think one reason that they resorted to a people's tribunal was that I think, you know, like you see with many other people's tribunals, is that they, this was basically the last resort. You know, the judiciary wasn't going to actually have a fair process to look into the impeachment proceedings, and obviously, you know, Congress was behind the impeachment, so they wanted to invite international people, academics and activists and jurors to look into the situation and to render a fair judgment. And the tribunal was based on the Russell Tribunal that was held in the 1960s looking at the crimes of the U.S. government in Vietnam, and ever since then we've had countless people's tribunals in various parts of the world. For example, I was myself part of a tribunal last year held on the Philippines in D.C. actually, again organized by social justice movements and activists in the Philippines, similarly as a last resort, so for the victims to have a chance to voice their voice their feelings about the crimes that they had suffered. So in this case, the tribunal was held over the course of 2 days. And as I said, we specifically looked at the impeachment proceedings. So obviously, the official reason for the impeachment that President Rousseff had moved money from one account to another, it was a bogus reason. This is something that's been done by Brazilian presidents before, and in any case, it's not a crime. So you see that, per various Brazilian laws, for a president to be impeached, she should have committed a very serious, grave offense, and this definitely did not rise to the level of serious crime. Whereas, as has been mentioned, many of the people behind the impeachment proceedings and going after President Rousseff are themselves being accused of really serious corruption, including Temer himself. We, as members of the jury, the nine of us, which I should say represented the U.S., various Latin American countries and various European countries, we had the opportunity to hear from various witnesses from both sides, including Professor Marsha Tiburi, who's a feminist scholar, and she spoke about the impeachments as an attack on President Rousseff as a woman. And, all of the various sexist language and rhetoric that is being employed by these right-wing politicians, all the caricatures and, attacks that are being used against her, including making fun of the fact that she was arrested and tortured as a leftist guerrilla, back in the 1970s. Another witness, coming more from an economic social justice perspective, said that basically allowing the impeachment to proceed will be disastrous for Brazil's working class, as we've already seen, because Temer and his all-white male cabinet, they have obviously quickly moved to cut social programs that were championed by Rousseff and her Workers' Party. And so the members of the jury, based on the extensive evidence that was presented to us, we found that what is happening is actually a conspiracy against democracy. And it's definitely a coup to basically try to stall the corruption investigations. As I mentioned, the investigations that had started against the crimes by some of these right-wing politicians. And we also found that the removal of Rousseff from office violates all principles of the democratic process and Brazilian constitutional order. And so I know Alex is going to delve into this in much more depth, but the issue of the U.S. stance on the coup is very important because it's very reminiscent of other process-based coups that we've seen, in the past few years, so in Paraguay and in Honduras. Honduras specifically, the National Lawyers Guild, an organization that I'm a member of, had the opportunity to travel to Honduras in 2013, right after the post-coup elections. And so, we met with various social justice activists and labor activists that were under attack, including Berta Caceres, the indigenous and environmental rights activist, who even at that time was on a death list that she showed us, and she was living underground. And so obviously, we've seen what has happened, her murder and other members of her group have been affected, and many others. And, I myself actually, my day-to-day work, I work on immigrants' rights issues. And, the coup, you can argue, led to the atmosphere of militarization and, attacks on ordinary people who then had to flee for their lives and come to this country, which, obviously has not been hospitable by any stretch of the imagination to refugees from Honduras and other Central American countries, rather putting women and children in prison. So you know, this is the impact of a U.S.-supported coup. You know, unfortunately, it remains to be seen, you know, what happens in Brazil with this coup. And I should mention that other members of the jury, specifically the ones who are from Latin America, were saying that this coup is being, you know, what is happening, is being watched very closely in various Latin American countries, you know, especially in places like El Salvador with a progressive government in place, for fear that it could very easily be replicated elsewhere by right-wing forces with the support of the U.S. government, who have no love for the you know, progressive and leftist agendas in these countries. So hopefully, you know, we can talk some more during the question and A about what is it that, you know, we as Americans can do further to try to put pressure on our government to hopefully at least modify its stance a little bit. So thank you.
Thank you. Alex, please.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you to IPS, and it's a pleasure to be giving this talk in your shiny new locale, which is conveniently just a couple blocks away from CBER, so it was nice to have a stroll over here. And at CEPR, so that's the Center for Economic and Policy Research, on our international side, we look a lot at Latin American countries, at economic policy in those countries, and at U.S. policy towards a variety of Latin American countries. And over the summer and the beginning of this fall, we've done a lot of writing on Brazil, and there are a couple of articles in the back there behind John, as well as a congressional letter that circulated over the summer that we supported. But anyway, I think, you know, it's pretty well established, even for those who limit their reading to sort of the New York Times, that, you know, something went very, very wrong in Brazil with this impeachment. And I think even the New York Times editorials have highlighted kind of the flawed and illegitimate nature of the justification behind the impeachment and the whole process itself. I think what's been discussed a lot less has been the U.S. position towards what's been happening in Brazil. And so I wanted to focus on that. And first of all, talk about their position during this whole impeachment process, during the trial of Dilma Rousseff, and then following the impeachment, which many referred to as a coup or a soft coup, and then try to analyze a bit the reasons for the U.S.'s position. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that the U.S. hasn't come out, you know, didn't come out, certainly, fully in support of the impeachment process. That much we can say. But from very early on, they sort of gave it a blanket endorsement, suggested that everything was fine. And the repeating statements that we saw from the State Department that got questioned a lot between the time that Dilma Rousseff was the first step in her impeachment process, which occurred in the lower house on April 17th. From then until she was impeached definitively on August 31st, the statements that were repeated by the State Department were that they were very confident in the Brazilian political process and that everything was being dealt with, you know, very democratically and constitutionally. And so this occurred, for instance, April 18th, and, you know, just after the lower house had voted to impeach Dilma Rousseff. And with these efforts having been led by Eduardo Cunha, a politician who was already implicated in, you know, massive corruption and alleged to have taken up to $40 million worth of bribes. And the U.S. Statement, again, suggested that everything was fine with the process. And just 2 days after it occurred, a very senior level State Department official, Thomas Shannon, met with one of the senators spearheading the impeachment effort in the Brazilian Senate, Aloysio Nunes. And this was widely seen as a gesture of support towards the impeachment process in Brazil. Later on, after the Senate confirmed her impeachment and that she was going to trial, and she was then suspended. Temer came in very quickly, and although he was just interim president, he completely restructured the government, as was already discussed, eliminated some of the ministries focused on social policies, announced some broad reforms, and brought in a cabinet, again, of all conservative white males. And again, he was just in the situation of interim presidency. Dilma Rousseff was still the constitutional president at this point, had not been, you know, permanently removed, and yet these sweeping changes were carried out. And the U.S. line remained the same, and they confirmed that they wanted to maintain a very strong bilateral relationship with Brazil, and they said, we've said multiple times that we believe that Brazil's democratic processes and democratic institutions are stable enough, strong enough, so that it can weather this political crisis. So I think it's important to emphasize that by this stage, there were a lot of voices throughout the region that did not concur with the U.S. whatsoever. And they included the OAS, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And as I just mentioned, there was a congressional letter that was signed by over 40 members of Congress, which said, basically, you know, there are a lot of things to be concerned about with this process. We believe that the U.S. should refrain from any gestures that could be interpreted as supportive of the interim government. And they cited the example of the meeting between Thomas Shannon and Senator Nunes. And they said that the U.S. State Department should clearly signal its concern with, you know, what was happening in Brazil. These were all congressional Democrats, and the letter was addressed to Secretary of State John Kerry. Well, just a few weeks after that letter, Kerry met with the foreign minister, José Serra. And this was, of course, when he was on his way to the Olympics, but he could very well have avoided meeting with Serra. And they held a very public press conference. And in this press conference, that didn't get a lot of attention here, but certainly got a lot of attention in Brazil, Serra, who is the current foreign minister of Brazil, he announced that the meeting between Kerry and himself represented the first step of a new phase in the relationship between Brazil and the United States. And then Kerry, in his statement, sort of confirmed that sentiment and said, I think it's an honest statement to say that over the course of the last few years, the political discussions here in Brazil had not allowed the full blossoming, if you will, of the potential of this relationship. And he said that going forward, the relationship, particularly the economic relationship, had enormous potential for growth. So this was, again, before Dilma Rousseff had been permanently removed from her post, which occurred on August 31st. Well, since then, there have been a lot more overt gestures of support from the U.S. government. And for instance, Vice President Joe Biden recently met with President Temer when they were at the UN General Assembly in New York. And they presented a readout to the public where Biden commended Temer for his commitment to maintaining Brazil's regional and global leadership role during the recent period of political change in Brazil. And then more recently, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew met with the Brazilian Finance Minister Henrique Meirelles, and he very openly applauded the reform package, the neoliberal reforms that Temer has been supporting. And I think it's significant that Treasury was doing this, because Treasury often, you know, we focus on Treasury's role in the U.S., but internationally, they often send signals to international investors as to, you know, where, you know, they should focus their investments. So, all right, well, I'm going to very quickly go over some of the reasons why I think the U.S. has taken these positions, which I think clearly signal its support for the political transition, the coup in Brazil. I think, for one, some of these domestic policies, which Alina has already gone into, Temer has surrounded himself with what Goldman Sachs has called a dream team of economic advisors, and it's been a total return to Washington consensus policies with announcements of some sweeping privatizations, pension reform, cuts to health and education, despite those sectors being protected under the Brazilian Constitution, deregulation of the market, changes to labor laws, et cetera, et cetera. And Temer, and Alina was also mentioning this, in the Council of the Americas in New York, he basically said, look, Dilma Rousseff was removed because she wasn't on board with this sort of drastic economic program. He was talking, of course, to U.S. You know, business interests. And, you know, ironically, Dilma, much to the dismay of a lot of her supporters, did support, you know, a fairly neoliberal business economic program. But it really wasn't enough for Brazil's financial and business elites that have had an enormous influence in Brazil. So I think the U.S., you know, has been supportive of this process, both because it signifies that there's an attractive environment for foreign investors and U.S. investors, and a very attractive environment for the financial sector. And we have to remember that the U.S. has a lot of financial interests, with Citibank, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, all playing a big role in the financial sector in Brazil. And finally, I wanted to focus just a little bit on the international side of things, where I think this new government has really heralded a new foreign policy agenda, and in fact it's called by José Serra the new Brazilian foreign policy, that's very much more in line with the U.S. foreign policy agenda. And José Serra, immediately when he took office on May 16th, he outlined a few of the key points, which I think the U.S. agreed with. And he said that the Brazilian foreign policy would no longer be ideological, and it, as you know, in terms of its practical application, this has meant that Brazil has been undoing its alliances with left governments in the region. It would no longer defend democracy. Sorry, in other countries, and of course, Brazil has been focused particularly on Venezuela and other left governments in terms of applying U.S. sort of standards of democracy. He announced that they would abandon multilateral efforts. Sorry, I must really be done. Okay, I'm going to wrap up in just a minute. So abandon multilateral efforts, and indeed, Serra is talking about sort of dismantling the Mercosur bloc as we know it, and allowing Brazil and Mercosur member countries to carry out bilateral agreements, including with the U.S. And the European Union. And he's been speaking of building bridges with the Pacific Alliance and Mexico. And some of you may know the Pacific Alliance is an alliance of countries with free trade agreements with the U.S. Who have, you know, a very overtly right-wing and neoliberal agenda. So, you know, I think that's most of what I wanted to say. And there's sort of a new regional configuration, which I think the U.S. has played a big role in supporting, perhaps not directly involved in all these political transitions, but certainly a major promoter of the transitions that have been taking place in Brazil and in Argentina in particular. Thanks.
Thank you, Alex. So I guess I wasn't exaggerating when I said that we might need to start from scratch again, another type of democratic-oriented governments in Latin America. Of course, there are still countries like Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia struggling, but they're struggling with deep economic crisis and also internal democratic crisis. So the big question is what to do. What to do next for all the people working from Washington to the Patagonia and to Canada to recover this hemisphere. We had defeated the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas 10 years ago, or 11 years ago already, with the great help, of course, of Brazil. Now Brazil, as Alex has explained, is overturning and ready to embrace the free trade agenda of Washington. I will open the session for a discussion and a Q&A. So if we take a first round of questions or comments, I would ask you to say your names and your affiliation if possible. John. let's take three. Yeah. You will start. Two more. Yeah. And someone else? Well, three over there. Okay, John, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. So John Cavanna from the Institute for Policy Studies. That was fantastic, all three of you, and deeply disturbing, you know, as someone who doesn't work specifically on Brazil. And, of course, I think for those of us who follow Latin America generally, but don't follow it as closely, it for me, was sending flashbacks to 2009 and Honduras and, you know, trying to think of what we did then and what we could have done more of and what we didn't. And, of course, the alignment in Latin America was different in 2009. And I'm also struck just from one thing that, you know, Manuel was saying. Of course, we are watching complete change in global geopolitics now into year two of the collapse of fossil fuel prices, where, you know, the countries that were, if you were thinking of, you know, Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador, all of them, you know, their economies completely turned upside down by that collapse in those prices. But I would love it if each of you, you know, as part of this, would say more. This is a fantastic letter in July that you all, and I'm sure you were all involved in this, that we passed around. But one, it's great you got those members, and two, it's wonderful to see the unions and Friends of the Earth and Amazon Watch and so on, the groups that you got involved in this. So there's actually a lot of power in this list of people. But it is appalling then to hear about, you know, John Kerry and Joe Biden and the fact that, and Jacob Lew, and the fact that this power here didn't, you know, that is politically aligned, if you will, with Kerry and Biden and Lew did not have an impact on that. So it's appalling to hear this. And it's appalling that we haven't been able to do more. So I guess very specifically, one, other forces in Latin America and Europe and other parts of the world that you feel are strong allies and are doing something. And two, just given you did this, and I know made other noise after the end of August coup, but just other things that you feel we should be doing now in these waning formats of the Obama administration.
I'm Chris. I'm a next leader fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies. I work on the Global Economy Project with Sarah Anderson. My question is about electoral reform and the structure of the coalition government in Brazil, and is that sort of an indication of a wider problem? Recently, Brazil just had municipal elections. The Workers' Party was thoroughly defeated, but more, I think, significant was that even though voting is obligatory in Brazil, in 10 states, the number of absentee or spoiled or just empty ballots was higher than the first place candidate. And that included in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo and also Belo Horizonte. In addition to that, you know, Lula, when he was running for president, you know, he ran two times before he was actually elected. The third time he was elected, he actually got increasingly sort of less progressive. And one of the narratives that I see coming out of there is that, you know, Lula kind of had to play the game to actually get elected. So I guess my question is this sort of a broader problem with electoral reform and the structure of the government in Brazil and not necessarily the parties? And the second question about the austerity measures, and if you guys want to speak on this, anyone really, the Bolsa Família, if you think that will be under threat, and is that sort of on the chopping block? And Bolsa Família is a conditional cash transfer program for poor Brazilian residents.
Thank you, Chris. one third question.
I'm Andy Sibokini. I'm a New Mexico Fellow in Institute for Policy Studies. I work with the Black Worker Initiative and New Economy Maryland Project. I wanted to call to your question on the panel about what the American people can be doing, putting pressure on the government or other ways to support the Brazilian people, particularly how we can utilize resources we already have. You know, we have strong social movements and a lot of energy right now. I think specifically of the Movement for Black Lives, which, you know, is starting to engage more in internationalism and, of course, has moved to Pan-Africanism, so I definitely see connections there. But any other movement that people have seen, things that are already going on, or how we continue to move that forward, I think that's very important.
Okay, we're going to take those three questions. Just let me read one passage of the letter to Congress, which quotes the National Coordination of Black Organizations of Brazil, saying that the coup underway in Brazil is an attack on the fragile democracy reinstalled in the country after the end of the military dictatorship, on our social conquests, and above all, on a project for a Brazil with inclusion and economic and social development, with sustainability, racial and gender equality, and the fight against racism. That is the National Coordination of Black Organizations.
That's me this time. I give myself more time.
I wanted to quote it to just to make a link in what you just said and the importance of black movements in Brazil and here in the United States. You want to start, Aline? Responding, whatever. Questions.
Okay, so I'm going to start backwards. So what do I think American people can do? One thing is denounce. We need people to speak out about what is going on in Brazil, because we had a media blockage, a media blackout, I'm sorry, really strong here. And ties to the local elections that we just held in Brazil. Since we get the local elections, they were done in the whole country. What is the narrative now? How are you saying this is a coup when we clearly held democratic elections? And indeed, we did. But the coup was to overthrow the Workers' Party, to change the project, the political project that was implemented. So in one sense, it is hard to get the word out there. Another thing is that Brazilian popular movements, they need to have a strong international support now. That guy that I was talking about, that he just, after being Sérgio Etchegóin, he is a person that has openly said that the Brazilian landless movement is a threat to the country. He has said in interviews that now that he is the head of ABIN will fulfill its role and will fulfill the mission that was given to him by Temer to surveil left-wing and progressive movements in Brazil. For the first time in the history of the Brazilian landless movement, it has 30 years of history, it is the first time that we have four activists of the movement being prosecuted under the law that regulates criminal organizations. So this is setting a very, very dangerous precedent in the country. They are trying to criminalize social and popular struggles. And those activists, there are we call them political prisoners, because they are being prosecuted in completely sigilo.
Silence.
And secrecy. So we don't have access to them, we don't know what the process, we don't even know what are the specific accusations against them. So this is one point. And the other one that I would like to quickly address and then give space, is about the local elections. Thanks for bringing this up. This is really important. So it is for the it is the first time in the history of the Workers' Party that it had a downturn in electorate in local offices. It was a huge blow. I think this has many explanations. Of course, the impeachment was very important to this result. But there is also one thing that is really important for us to understand is the role that have been playing by the media in Brazil in criminalizing the Workers' Party and its historical cadres. The corruption investigations, although other parties in the country are more deeply involved, I'm not saying that the Workers' Party wasn't involved in corruption, probably was, but other parties, we have more evidence, more proof that they were directly connected to this corruption scheme. However, all we see every day in Brazilian media is a war on the Workers' Party in its legacy, its history, its political agenda. Besides that, I think you are very right. The high level of absence in the country indicates that Brazilians are profoundly disappointed with all the political spectrum in the country. And yes, we need a political reform.
Okay, so some great questions, and I'm not sure where to start. I think maybe, Chris, when you were talking about the issue of electoral reform, I think that's really important. I think, yes, I mean, Lula, you know, had to do a lot of pact making, basically in order to stay in power. And I think this has a lot to do, not just with the electoral system, but also with, just as in this country, and the way it influences politics, campaign finance, which is very opaque in Brazil, and we know involves a huge amount of money from Brazilian corporations. But at any rate, what happened to the Workers' Party from the beginning and throughout the entire time that they were in power was that they always won the presidential elections, but they never won the legislative elections. And I think it had a lot to do with this. Therefore, they had to have pacts with parties that were very much embedded in the system, like the PMDB, which Michel Temer comes from, and parties that had been engaging in corruption. Because what's not mentioned about the Lava Jato, the car wash operation today, is that the system that's in place, this corruption scheme, has existed since the early 90s. This far predates the Workers' Party and very much involved the PMDB, the PSDB, and some of these other parties. And the PT became part of that system as well, unfortunately. So on the one hand, campaign finance reform, and on the other, I think media reform as well. And you see this, obviously, in a lot of Latin American countries, and it's true here as well, but I think it's more of a sort of a caricatural situation in a lot of Latin America, but certainly in Brazil, where you have, for instance, the TV network Globo, which has a near monopoly on television market throughout the country. Globo, of course, was a network that developed during the dictatorship that has remained very firmly entrenched with the sort of right-wing interests of Brazil. And that from the beginning, and since long before Lula was first elected, waged a constant campaign against the Workers' Party. And this is true also of the written press. All of the major press in Brazil has been anti-PT from day one. And so, we see a real concentration of media interests in the hands of, the elite capital interests of Brazil that has a major influence on public opinion all the time. And certainly in the case of Dilma's impeachment, a lot of Brazilians thought the impeachment had to do with corruption, when in fact the allegation of, there was no allegation of corruption against Dilma Rousseff, but I think most Brazilians didn't know that. They believed that this had to do with corruption and that the PT was sort of the driving force behind corruption in the country. And this continues today with the trial, or not yet trial, but certainly the indictment of Lula da Silva, the charges that have been lodged against him, where he's called the commander of the whole corruption scheme, despite there not being any evidence of that. So I think those are two things that Brazil kind of needs to deal with. And internally, as Alina was mentioning, these attacks on social movements, there's a very sinister piece of legislation in Brazil called the anti-terrorism law, one that's been replicated in other Latin American countries and often backed by the U.S. As well, and has been turned against the so-called domestic terrorists that include social movements such as the MST. There have been a lot of protests since Dilma's final impeachment on August 31st. There have been hundreds of thousands of people protesting. The repression has been very strong, so I think that's something to look out for. And I wanted to unpack some of the things that John was asking about. And John, you talk about the problem of the commodities boom and so on. I think that is a problem. But at CEPR, we've looked at that. And another big problem that the left governments faced is that they implemented pro-cyclical policies. And very paradoxically, went back to sort of the neoliberal playbook. And I think this had a lot to do, certainly in the case of Brazil, with these very tight constraints on the Dilma government. The very fact that she had pledged to adopt an anti-neoliberal agenda to invest more in social programs and so on, and reversed course once she was in power. I think there was a lot of pact-making that was going on there as well. And again, it wasn't enough. And once there was the opportunity, and of course, because of these pro-cyclical policies, the austerity measures that were applied in Brazil, this made things much worse, made the economic situation worse, and made it much easier to get rid of Dilma Rousseff, to prepare public opinion for that to happen. So I think beyond the commodities boom, we have to look as well at this sort of paradoxical continuation of neoliberalism as part of the problem with the not just the economic downturns in these countries, but these unfortunate political transitions. And in terms of what we can do here in the U.S., I think, internationally, there's been outcry. When Michel Temer stood up to speak at the UN General Assembly, you had six Latin American countries that walked out. Costa Rica later said it was a mistake. It's not very clear what happened. but at any rate...
Which were the other?
The others were more the usual suspects. In this case, Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, Cuba...
Nicaragua.
Thank you. At any rate, but there's also, because, of course, the PT is so close to the labor movement in Brazil, the CUT in particular, which has, of course, a vast network internationally, the ICTU has been playing a very, very big role in trying to rally people still. I mean, the question is now what can be done? Now that this impeachment has happened, it's very difficult to reverse that. But the thing is, again, there are these attacks on social movements. There's also, I think, the attempt to sort of permanently marginalize the PT from politics ahead of the 2018 elections. And, of course, Lula remains the most popular political figure in Brazil. The polling shows that. He's not as popular as he was, but he would probably win an election if he were to stand today. And today, this very well-articulated, massive media campaign is focused on him with the help of some very biased judges and prosecutors, including Sergio Moro, who often comes to Washington, D.C., who was a State Department fellow back in the day, and who has done some very, very biased things as he has for one thing, I mean, the Brazilian legal system is very strange indeed, where you have the judge who is both the investigator and also the trial judge. And this is the case of Sergio Moro. He is both investigating and prosecuting Lula and will dictate the final verdict. And he's been on a campaign against Lula from day one. There have been some weak charges against Lula that were never brought forward until just recently. I think Moro was emboldened by the impeachment to go forward with some of these charges against Dilma. I won't go into the details here unless people are really interested, but there's plenty of material on this. But at any rate, even if all of this material that even if the charges against Dilma or against Lula are true, it doesn't suggest, none of it suggests that he is in any way the mastermind behind this corruption scheme. And that is, in fact, what this judge and the prosecutors that are with him are accusing him of. And he's being, you know, basically accused of a crime before he's even been tried. By the very judge who's going to try him. So there are lots of issues with the case against Lula. They've also leaked a lot of information to the press, including illegally wiretapped conversations between Lula and Dilma. He did a number of things where he stepped completely out of bounds and showed clear bias in this case, and he should have been removed from the case, but he hasn't been. And he has, again, all of Brazil's major media behind him. So I think this is what we're looking at over the next few months, is the attempt to sort of destroy what's left of the PT and make sure they don't win in 2018, and what we should be looking out for. Lula is being represented before the UN Human Rights Commission by a very well-known human rights defender, Jeffrey Robertson, who also took up the case of Julian Assange a few years ago. And he's drawn up a petition that makes a very compelling case that, you know, I think we can send around. And, you know, it goes into a lot of details, but I think it shows to what extent this is really an unfair judicial persecution against Lula. And in terms of what we can do, I mean, again, you mentioned this coalition of groups, keeping them alive and keeping them engaged on these issues. I think, you know, we all need to kind of do it and say it's not over yet. There's still a struggle ahead.
So I would just have to say, obviously, I'm not at all surprised by the stance of the U.S. government on this coup, you know, very reminiscent, as has been mentioned several times, of their stance on various previous coups. I just, you know, I keep remembering the meeting that we had in 2012, the National Lawyers Guild delegation with the U.S. ambassador, you know, talking about the violence being specifically directed at the human rights activists and labor activists, and she was just completely dismissive of the targeted nature of that violence. And then, you know, our delegation obviously documented the massive fraud that was happening in the course of the elections, and the U.S. ambassador comes out with a statement, you know, that evening that what we witnessed was, she said, it's a festival of democracy. So, you know, I think we've seen that same attitude from the U.S. government in response to this coup as well. And I think the answer lies in very much what you mentioned, is the social justice movements and the continued connections that our movements should be making. So we saw this in the case of Black Lives Matter movement, specifically on Palestine, where folks from the movement for Black Lives went to Palestine over the summer. Despite very vigorous crackdown by the Israelis actually didn't allow five of the delegation members to get in, but that didn't intimidate the rest of the delegation to go in and to witness by themselves what was happening and the oppression and document and come back and then very courageously include their support for Palestinian liberation in the vision for Black Lives, despite what we've seen, the massive attacks from various organizations nationally, unfortunately, kind of trying to undermine the Black Lives Matter movement because of their support for Palestine and their support for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So I think those same connections could be made with what is happening in Brazil, with the various social justice movements in Brazil, the MST and the Afro-Brazilian movements. Specifically, and again, connecting all of this, Brazil, I think, in Latin America and maybe worldwide, was one of the places that was very supportive of Palestine. So, the first World Social Forum on Palestine was held in Brazil. That I and along with 200 others from North America attended back in 2012, and the government was supportive of that convening. And as we all remember, more recently Dilma refused to allow an ambassador from Israel who was in support of the settlements. Again, making an exceptionally courageous stance. I think we just have to continue to make the connections and hopefully mobilize together and make some noise.
Thank you. I'll open the door again for more questions or comments. Anyone?
My name is Hector Perla. I'm at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. So one of the things that I've seen, and I've kind of seen this, and I guess you guys have all talked about it a little bit, but this transition from a old-style military coup to a new style, right, of soft coups, and trying to distinguish that between a legitimate impeachment process, right? Because what I've confronted, right, in trying to explain and kind of denounce what happened in Brazil is kind of a like, no, it was an impeachment process. They followed the rules. They did everything. And so just wanted to hear kind of maybe collective thoughts on how do we distinguish? How do we, because I think what's happening is going to happen. This is a new, what I'm seeing is this is a new strategy, the new right. modality for attacking the 21st century left in Latin America. Right? And the case of El Salvador, I think, is exactly, they're laying the foundations for that happening right now. So just wanted to hear kind of like how, if anyone has ideas on how do we push this a little bit. Right?
And if I may, I was going to make the question too of how do we create mechanisms or shields democratic governments not to fall so easily onto these traps created by the right. No? Any other question or we pass to John?
Just a quick one that is a question from Almudena Benavim, who was here 2 weeks ago for our awards and met with Sampo and Manuel and me and others. She posed the question of whether, first of all, she feels that there's a sort of a deep sexism in this as well, and also in the attacks on Michelle Bachelet in Chile, but was raising, it's sort of similar to this previous question, whether she was posing that maybe, and I know a couple of you know the law far better than we do, whether a project that is really looking into also the constitutions of several Latin American countries, where she was claiming it's sort of easier to do this kind of political coup, and that's part of what we should be examining. But she was, I think, hoping that different groups could come together around that, around a deeper, broader, more Latin America-wide look at impeachment. So just to put that on the table.
Perhaps we could have another round for this particular issue, which is very important to get out some thoughts and carry out some plans.
So you want to start with the data?
So, I mean, just in response to your question, how do we distinguish this coup from a legitimate impeachment proceedings, I would just encourage people to check out the judgment of our tribunal. It was very legal and technical, very much based and rooted in Brazilian laws. And you can find that it's in Portuguese and it's in Spanish and it's on the website of the MSD.
But you have the article in The Nation, right?
Right. It's. I do have an article in The Nation about this, but it's not linked. The judgment is not linked in my article, I don't think. But you can, you know, you can just search for it and then just look that up. And in terms of, you know, your question, I think we just need to continue our awareness-raising campaign. So I know a lot of our organizations send delegations to Latin America, the National Lawyers Guild, and School of America's Watch, and I'm sure DC-based organizations. You know, I think we need to continue to do that. I know, you know, we've been going down to Venezuela and then, you know, coming back and talking about our experience and what we're seeing on the ground. And I think our voices, again, as Americans, it's very important to try to dispel some of the disinformation campaigns by corporate media that's happening right now.
So, Hector, you wrote a good piece in the Post, actually, on soft coups. You're kind of the expert. You could answer
I guess
you
could
But, I mean, in the case of the Brazilian coup, there was one thing that I think made it really blatantly clear that this was a coup, which was this leaked telephone conversation that included one of Temer's ministers. And, you know, most of what's said about that conversation is that he, you know, emphasized the fact that they had to get rid of Dilma. And this conversation was one that took place before she began to be impeached, before the lower house had even voted. But the emphasis has been put on the fact that they said, we have to get rid of her in order to stop these, you know, corruption investigations from continuing. It's decimating our ranks, you know, the PMDB and the PSDB. But also in that conversation, he said, you know, look, we have, you know, the media on our side, we have, you know, the judges are on our side, the military is with us. And that really gave you a sense of, wait a minute here, what kind of a democratic process is this? If, like, you know, all of these different bits and pieces that are supposed to be independent powers are aligned and collaborating with somebody who's trying to stop the corruption investigations, right? So that should have raised some huge alarm bells, and it didn't in the U.S. State Department, or at least they didn't mention it. So I think you do have kind of this new strategy where everything remains, you know, nominally within a constitutional framework, but where clearly the intent of any constitution is being violated, right? The principles of the constitution. In this case, there's the issue of the crime of responsibility. And, I mean, it's laughable, the charges that they came up with against Dilma Rousseff. I mean, what, you know, it can hardly be called a crime of responsibility, a major, you know, state crime. There's no way you can say that. But that issue was kind of left to one side, and they just proceeded with everything, you know, very institutionally. And you know, if you were reading the Brazilian major media, everything seemed perfectly fine with the whole process. But I think also, you know, and this is where the U.S. comes into play a little bit, there is a strategy of attrition. So you've had the case now in Brazil and in Argentina, and it's also the case in Venezuela. All these countries are, you know, face some serious economic difficulties. And I think the U.S. has kind of played a role in making it worse in some cases. And I think that's certainly true in Argentina and Venezuela, and I can explain why. I think in Argentina, basically the U.S., just as Jack Lew went to Brazil recently and said, you know, yes, Brazil is open for business, back in 2011, the Treasury Department sent a very clear signal that Argentina was closed for business. The U.S. blocked all multilateral loans to Argentina. And beyond, you know, the fact that these loans were blocked, that sends a signal to international investors that, you know, you can't really trust Argentina. You can't invest in this country. And I think it really did hurt Argentina a great deal to be isolated, you know, from international markets during all this time. And as soon as Macri came into power, just days after his inauguration, Jack Lew very publicly announced that this embargo, this effective embargo on multilateral loans, had been lifted before Macri had done anything, okay, just to give you a sense of the U.S. role there. In terms of Venezuela, you know, there's a lot of internal problems in Venezuela. There's been, you know, frankly, and we've been saying so at CPR, you know, they've made some very poor policy judgments over the last few years. But on top of that, I think the U.S. has made things worse by also playing a role in isolating Venezuela in terms of international markets. And one of the things it's done, of course, is labeled Venezuela an extraordinary national security threat, started a sanctions regime that's limited to a few officials. But this also sends a signal. International investors, you know, the big banks and so on, and Venezuela is in desperate need right now of cash, they're not going to invest in a country where the U.S. sends these kind of signals. Beyond that, we've heard internally, we've been in touch with some people at some big Wall Street banks, that their legal departments are telling them that the U.S. Treasury has said, you can't go into Venezuela. There's a very clear line about that. And so here again, this is just making the situation worse in Venezuela, just as it made the situation worse in Argentina. So this is another aspect of U.S. policy that's a little bit more insidious, I think, but that needs to be looked at a bit more.
I think that, and Alex mentioned this before, one thing that we need to understand of this new soft coups that are going on in Latin America is that they are being slowly built throughout the time. Rousseff's impeachment was not something that happened overnight. There is the media campaign against the PT, there is the narrative against the corruption. Why now the corruption? And this is when you hear a Department of State briefing on Latin America, what are the three axes? Fighting corruption, human rights, and drug trafficking. So these are the new narrative against progressive forces in Latin America. So this is something that has been built for a long time. Specifically in the case of Rousseff, although they have this, they constructed the narrative again. Narrative is really important. They constructed this narrative that they have followed all the legal and constitutional process. But when you take a closer look, it's not hard to see that that there was clearly breaches of the law. In more than one occasion, Dilma's right to have a full defense was denied. For example, when the lower house voted the legal piece asking for her impeachment, the original legal piece had three allegations against her. The impeachment commission decided to put forward just two. But when the deputies had the vote in the lower house, they voted the whole three. So how can you fully defend yourself, if you don't even know what you have to defend? And then again, the accusation couldn't prove that she had committed, as Zidi said, she had committed an impeachable crime. And they were so, you know, out there with that when Janaína Pascoal, well, this is, Alex said his red flag. My red flag started when I learned that the lawyer that made the legal piece for the impeachment was hired by the PSDB, which is the party that lost the last presidential elections by the PT. So she was hired by, they paid like $8,000 for her to come up with some legal allegations. And she drafted this legal petition that led to the impeachment process, but she argued in her final statement, because she couldn't prove that, you know, Dilma was directly involved with those allegations, she argued that the senators should analyze the matter beyond her initial complaint. and look at systematic political choices and decisions. So we are not, Brazil is not a parliamentary system. We don't have a vote of non-confidence. How can you impeach a democratic elected president under so flimsy allegations? We don't have proof. So they constructed the narrative, and then again the role played by the media in stress that no, it was legal, it was constitutional. But it's not hard to find the evidence that due process wasn't followed there.
I have a question about social support and the erosion also of the social basis, given this paradox that you were talking about. I mean, you mentioned that during Lula and Dilma, there was a lot of social progress, which gave way, of course, to the right's reaction. But there was also a paradox because neoliberal programs were also implemented. So I know, I think this paradox is very difficult to explain. But I have the impression that, you know, the marches in the streets by the right wing or the people looking for the impeachment were really impressive. They mm-hmm. have the media, of course, to portray that. But I also have the impression that the social basis needed to come out and defend Dilma against the impeachment were a little bit eroded already. I don't know if you can talk about that.
Yeah, thanks for asking, because this is a really piece to understand also how we got to the impeachment process. As Alex said, Dilma's second term, she made some choices that were really against the political project that were voted in the ballot box. She was implemented very liberal, neoliberal policies. But I think this detachment of the Workers' Party with its traditional base is something that has been happening for a long time. Dilma's second term was the final, you know, blow to a situation that was already very, pretty bad. Her reforms, her economic reforms, directly affected poor worker families. So I met with this Brazilian union leader, and she was telling me that when they held meetings to talk about the impeachment, to talk about the political situation, the workers, you know, simply stand up and leave the room. They didn't want to talk about this. They were like, okay, she asked her to vote for her, and now she's implementing changes that goes directly against the our interests. This situation, this led to the vote in the lower house that put Temer as an interim president. The situation started to change a little bit when Temer started implementing his agenda. So the workers start to realize, yes, it was bad, but now we are in an even worse and unthinkable situation. That's when the protests against the impeachment started to build up and be more larger, more cohesive, more throughout the country. But yes, this is important. The Workers' Party detached itself from the base.
I think there was a question, man, back there. You were raising your hand.
Well, basically, I'm from Brazil, and this whole thing reminds me of the saying we used to have way back when, however, minus five, and that's... Does anybody understand that? Well, and unfortunately, that continues. There's so much corruption that it's really hard to see that this side is not corrupt and the other side is corrupt. They both corrupt, unfortunately. And a lot of people, smaller, this little guy gets hurt. Some good things were done under Getúlio, when the people had, university education is free, provided you are able to pass the exams. And a lot of first generation immigrants, like a lot of Japanese, took advantage of that. I know two personally. One is a civil engineer, the other one is an anesthesiologist, and the father was a fisherman. Now, that's also because of the Japanese culture. They implemented, they helped their own children, the whole community. When the child was gifted, they would go behind and help them. But the fact is, the corruption is universal. It's called lobby. So I think it's basically very hot, hopeless, you know what I mean?
Well, I have a question that kind of is a follow-up to what you've been talking about, and that is, in terms of thinking like what we can do from here in the U.S., it seems like being in the supporting role makes sense. So if you could talk about kind of what the left in Brazil is doing to organize, you know, we've seen kind of divisions between the PSOL, PT, you know, how you approach going forward. So, you know, I mean, do you have any kind of clarity on what is going on in Brazil that we could then use to think about how we could support that?
Okay, you're more Brazilian than I am, but I was there recently. I went to a couple of protests, and this is one of my pictures, actually. There weren't as many people in the protest as I hoped to see, but the preceding weekend there was something like 100,000 people that were out on this avenue, the Paulista. And the rallying cry, there are two. One is Fora Temer, out with Temer. And I think probably most of Brazilian public opinion is now behind this slogan. I think they support it, despite the best attempts of the media to try to bolster Temer. And then the second slogan that's out there is Eleciones, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but Eleciones Diretas Ya.
Diretas Ya.
Okay, thank you. So direct elections now. And so there are two things in there. One is elections, for one thing, because obviously the current government is an unelected one. People aren't happy with that. The second part that was initially more mysterious to me, and then I got an explanation, is the direct elections. What does that mean exactly? And actually, what they mean by that is that all of the Brazilian electorate should be involved in making the choice. But what could happen, and this is apparently a genuine threat, is that things could get even worse in Brazil. Michel Temer isn't quite neoliberal enough for some people, and he could be removed through a similar impeachment. In fact, there's already an impeachment, probably a more justified impeachment drive against him at the moment. He's disqualified, by the way, from participating in future elections due to violating campaign finance laws that are already, you know, way too flexible as it is. So at any rate, he wouldn't be running in 2018, but there are those that want to get him out before then and replace him with a more neoliberal, even more neoliberal government. It seems hard to imagine. And this could happen if he's impeached next year rather than this year. If he's impeached next year, then according to the Brazilian Constitution, the next president is elected by the Congress rather than by the people of Brazil. The next president to finish, you know, the mandate of Dilma Rousseff, you know, that finishes at the end of 2018. And so that appears to be a real threat, to the extent that everybody in these protests around the country are saying direct elections now, need to happen now. So I thought, you know, that was interesting. And, you know, there's also, I saw signs also to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, to sort of the international community, saying they're repressing us, you know, please do something. Signs even in English. I don't know if one of them is up here, but so I think, you know, that's obviously the other thing, is that the protests were very big initially after August 31st, and after the initial repression, they became a lot smaller, I think, because people are, you know, understandably fearful of going out and protesting. So it's good to speak out about that.
But there is clearly a social bounce. I mean, from the relative lack of support needed there is now a reaction.
Yeah, much more so after August 31st, interestingly.
Right.
I mean, before that you had lots of sporadic protests.
Yeah.
But as soon as it happened, I think people were like, wait a minute, what just happened? How is it that this, how was she kicked out like this? And we had nothing to say about it.
I think, I think this is, again, on this soft coup strategy and this legal narrative is to demobilize people. So people weren't really understand, and that's why I, in my opinion, just after the 31st day started. I just wanted to make a quick comment on your comment. I agree with you that corruption in Brazil is a widespread situation, something that needs to be fought. But the problem is when you instrumentalize a historical struggle, historical need of the Brazilian people, which is the fight against corruption, and you use this to bring down a progressive party, to do a political persecution against a few cadres, and then you left out all the other corruptions in throughout the scheme. So this is very problematic. This is something we need to be attentive.
If there are no more questions, Netfa is suggesting that we could wrap up a little earlier. But if there are no more questions,
either way,
I have just about a big one, which is another subject, but it has to do with Brazil, of course. What's going to happen? I mean, you mentioned the economic agenda of Temer, which is completely neoliberal. What's going to happen to the BRICS? The BRICS were during the last year the real alternative to the unipolar or bipolar China-US hegemony of the world. But what would happen with Brazil in its participation with the BRICS countries? Is there any talk about that there?
Well, the BRICS are still, it is still not clear what is going to happen with the BRICS. In my opinion, they are still, I think there is still a power struggle there to understand. Definitely, what we can point out for foreign relations in Brazil is that we are going to come back to the what we call traditional parties, traditional partners, sorry, to the traditional parties. So, alliances with the global north in detriment with the global south. So probably this is something that indicates that the BRICS are going to have a downturn. And I think that also what Alex mentioned on the Mercosur might indicate it is that now the focus will be in bilateral economic relations and not to strengthen those kind of forums, multilateral institutions.
Yeah, I mean, I think the BRICS have had issues from the start, right? Including the fact that they basically replicate carbon copy sort of the current international financial institutions and what they're trying to do in terms of the fund that they're creating. They're modeled after the IMF to a certain extent, so that's a little bit troubling. And it doesn't look like it's going to get much better because between Brazil, India, which has also taken a more neoliberal turn, South Africa, which is just gone, off the charts in terms of neoliberalism, and then China, which there's an interesting debate I think going on internally, where I think there's a movement towards sort of less neoliberalism in internal debates, but it hasn't quite expressed itself in the foreign policy yet. But certainly in terms of Brazil, I think, Temer and especially José Serra have made clear, like Ilinas was saying, to go back to the traditional partnerships. Not much interest in sort of a multipolar world and South-South cooperation, which were, of course, things that Lula really stood behind. Dilma Rousseff was much less active on sort of the international front, unfortunately, but she did sort of maintain those policies, and it seems like a complete reversal, and I think it could be tragic for the BRICS, but also Latin American regional integration, where Brazil was such a key player, and now they kind of want to destroy all of the integration systems that exist.
Thank you, Alex. If there's no other pressing comment or question, Sade, would you have to have a last comment?
Well, I think just, you know, continuing to stay engaged. I mean, one organization that I myself try to stay involved with is the School of America's Watch, obviously, you know, bringing together the issues around Latin America and U.S. involvement in Latin America and try to shut down the School of America's, which obviously is based in Georgia. This year, they're having their convergence at the border because of, obviously, the connection between the issues of U.S. interference in Latin America and the issue of migration. And I believe the convergence is happening in a couple of days. So I think, you know, staying involved with that movement is very important.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much to the three speakers and to all of you for coming.